Welcome to episode 19 of the Empowering Ability Podcast.
Welcome to the Empowering Ability Podcast, where we get you and your loved ones impacted by disability the information needed to live a full and meaningful life. Now here is your host, Eric Gall.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Empowering Ability Podcast. This is your host, Eric Gall. And for all of our listeners, I just want to remind you that we are currently still recording our mini-series on housing for people with a disability. And if that's a topic that interests you, make sure to go over to empoweringability.org and grab the free download on creating your home. It's a great workbook that'll help you start to think about what your vision is for home and how to start to implement that and start the conversation. So go on over to empoweringability.org and grab that for you and your family. So today we continue with our mini-series on housing for people with a disability. This is part three of the six-part mini-series, and really excited about our guest today. Our guest is Jackie Goldstein, and Jackie has been compared to Anthony Bourdain in the way that she looks at community care models of providing support for people with mental illnesses and disabilities in the world. So she's traveled all over the world looking at different models and really acting as an observer to try and understand them and tease apart, you know, what's successful, why they're working, and to be able to share those learnings with other people. Jackie's also the author of the book Voices of Hope for Mental Illness, Not Against With, and we dive into a lot of the different models that she covers in the book. So I think you're going to enjoy that today. Jackie is also a speaker and an educator, and we're going to talk about the story of Gail Beldrum. And Gail Beldrum has this really cool community care model focused on a foster family setup. So it's really interesting because it started in the 13th century and it's still going on today. And Jackie tells the story and the legend behind that and how it started and evolved. And we talk about some other models that really kind of evolved or were inspired by Gail out of the United States, Broadway housing communities, and Gould Farm are the ones that we dive into in a little bit more detail. So Jackie and I dive right into the conversation today. So here we go. Enjoy. I think a good way to summarize kind of your research and expertise is kind of the I guess a good comparison is the Anthony Bourdain of the community care.
And that's what one of the reviewers said on the back of the book. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's kind of a good parallel.
It's good. I'm not an Anthony Bourdain fan. I don't dislike him, but it's just not the kind of show I like. So anyway, I know the kind of show, and I think that's a good thing. He's an observer.
Yes.
And Kamel, whatever his name is doing United Shades of America. He's an observer. And so we need to, observe the needs of the individuals in our community. And, observation is a really important thing. And I guess, like Anthony Bourdain, I'm an observer. I'm not a clinician. I'm not going to offer a diagnosis or a treatment, but I want to observe the individual people. And then I'm sharing those observations with those who provide the services, which is the community.
Mm-hmm. So as an observer, you've observed many different communities and learned along the way. And you mentioned Gail. Maybe that's a good place to start. Would you be able to just give a short kind of overview of maybe a little bit of the history and what you've observed in Gail?
Right. I'll start with the history. There is it revolves around St. Dymphna. And we don't know if St. Dymphna really existed. But the story goes that but there was a Celtic king who had a very beautiful wife, and he was used to having everything that he wanted, and a beautiful wife fulfilled part of that part of that need. The story goes, he lived in Armagh, which is where St. Patrick had started the church, and his wife came under the, was dedicated to being a Christian, and when she had a daughter, she wanted to raise her as a Christian, and so she had a priest who was kind of the nanny, I guess would be the best example. So Damon was the king, and his beautiful wife's name was Odila. So Damon didn't want to lose Odila. That was, you know, one of his sources of pride. And Odila died, and he was distraught, the story goes, and he wanted somebody as beautiful as Odila. And his committees, soldiers, whatever they might be at that time, searched far and wide and couldn't find somebody as beautiful as Odila. I keep emphasizing that's how the story goes. And so he suggested to the king, he said, well, you know, your daughter is the child of Odila, and she's as beautiful as Odila. And bingo, that really caught the attention of Damon. And so he went to Dimphna and to Jeroboam, who was the priest who was in charge of her care, and said that he wanted to marry her. And they said, nothing doing, you know, that's a sin, and that's not going to do that. And they supposedly, I mean, there's so many different variations on the story, but supposedly they asked for a night to think about it. And that's one of the stories. And they had no intention of following his demand, his treatment for his illness of being distraught, if you want to put it in modern day terms. So during the night, they escaped across the English Channel into the forests of Belgium. And Damon wasn't going to be deterred that easily. And so he sent his soldiers to go look for her, and a search ensued in which they found her. And he confronted her once again. She confronted her and the priest once again and said, you obey my demand or it's off with your head. And the priest, Jeroboam, didn't go along with it. And so his was the first head to roll. But that did not have an impression on Dimphna. And so Damon's anger grew and Dimphna's head came off. Now, there are several stories around what happened after that, and it's not really known which one is true. Something happened in Giel, and the first story I heard before I'd been to Giel, but when I just read about it, was that there were some patients or prisoners passing by, and when they saw the event of Dimphna's head coming off, that was such a shock to them that they were healed of their mental illness. That's not the most popular story. The most popular story, finally, you know, it was a legend that was passed on as an oral history, but finally it was put into a written record of why this young princess should be a saint. And she is to be the saint of lost causes, mental illness being one of them. And the reason that she deserves that title is because she did not give in to her father's madness. She stood her ground in terms of Christian morals and did not give in to her father's madness. Well, the word spread that there was this saint in Belgium who could cure people. And so people started coming to Belgium, and I outline this in the book, very a loose outline, because like I said, this is an oral history, and it becomes more of a written history once she was canonized. But so this was a time in the Middle Ages where people came to the church to be healed. And if you're going to go to a church to be healed, why not go to the church of the saint of lost causes, of mental illness and other lost causes? So there began to be an influx of patients to Giel to be healed. And nobody invited them. There were no references. This is all not the way it would be today. But they started coming into Giel. And the first thing that would happen in Giel is that they would go through a religious ceremony, which a novena, which is 9 days of praying. And I described that in the book. And if that worked, and it could have a placebo effect, then everything was well and good. But some of the patients, some of the pilgrims, we'll call them, it didn't work. But they were placed in homes. They didn't know what to do with the canons of the church, didn't know what to do with all of these people. And so they asked the townspeople to take them into their homes. Now remember, it was an agrarian community, and it would be easy to find work for someone who has any kind of disability. And so a deal would be made between the family of the patient, client, pilgrim, and the family who was going to take them in. And that was the beginning. And then in the book, I go into more detail about how that evolved. And it became such a part of the community that when there were efforts by the French, when they took over Belgium for a time, and the Belgian government, when they would try to stop it, when they even closed down the churches at one point in time, the community still, it was a source of so much pride to them that they would just individually on their own make a deal with the families. And so it kind of became the motto, the logo of Giel to the community. I mean, the community itself thought of them themselves as being a healing community. And the one anecdote that said is that in those days, if somebody didn't have a border in their home, it was wondered why. Was their home not good enough to have a border in it? And so it was a source of pride to the families of Giel. Because it was a source of pride, there wasn't any stigma towards mental illness. And in fact, if there were people who were brought in who were particularly violent, the people of Giel weren't afraid of them, but the farmers thought, oh, they've got a lot of energy. We could channel that energy into some useful work. So there you had the resources of the community filling the needs of several kinds of people. Some needed a more calming atmosphere. Some needed to do more work. So that was the history of Giel. And the way I found out that there may not be, we don't know who St. Dymphna was. We don't know what happened in Giel, because I was going to Ireland to visit. And I had begun my work on Giel. I visited Giel, and I visited things here. And I thought, well, I'm going to be in Armagh. Maybe I could visit the site, things in Ireland that were related to the Dymphna story. And so I communicated with some historians in Ireland, and they said, sorry, there is no St. Dymphna. That story is a myth. It's not entirely a myth, but so it wasn't an official thing. It's not the way we think of a system starting. It just evolved. And we really can't do that today. We can't let a system evolve, but we can take the same approach when we consider the needs of the clients and the resources of the city, that of a community. And it could be a community it could be a neighborhood in a larger community. Like in New York, there are a lot of wonderful facilities in New York. And in Los Angeles, the village takes a different approach. So does that give you enough information
for sure. And I want to dive into some of the U.S. communities that you visited. But just for our listeners, the book, Jackie's book that she referred to, the title is Voices of Hope for Mental Illness, Not Against, With. And I believe it's available on Amazon. Is that correct?
It is. It's available as a paperback, and I think it's available as a Kindle book also.
Okay.
And I had started work on the book, and I happened on to a quote by Robert Frost that I thought, oh my gosh, this is so much what I'm talking about. I'm going to use that. And at first, the book was going to be called Not Against With, but then it was suggested that that was too subtle, so I made it. But I made it the subtitle. And what Robert Frost said in an interview with a magazine, he said, always fall in with what you're asked to accept. Take what is given and make it over your way. My aim in life has always been to hold my own with whatever is going, not against with. Well, sometimes the approach that we take with mental illness, we don't go with what's going. We think that we can solve the mental illness problem rather than, well, I hate to say treat it, but rather than work around it, not go with it. So not against with is what I saw in all of the programs that I visited, beginning with Giel and then through the United States.
Mm-hmm. And from your book, Jackie, in Giel, one of the key things that stood out to me was the folks that come in and as boarders and live with a family. The family isn't told what their diagnosis is. Can you speak to
that? No, and they're not even told what their medications are. That's happening a little bit more now, but the tradition has always been, the family doesn't need to know the diagnosis. They're not the clinicians, they're the family.
Mm-hmm. So going along with that, that theme of not against with, how would that, play in those situations with those families?
Okay. Well, if you take what I just said, if you're given the diagnosis, for example, then you might think that your job is to deal with the diagnosis. This person is schizophrenic. They might do such and such and so on and so on. If you ignore that and you get to know the person, then you're going with what is. And the effort is to give them a life that is as close to what we call normal as possible. And that means meaningful activities, a comfortable home, a sense of being a part of a family and of a community.
Mm-hmm.
And Ellen Baxter, I mean, you wisely chose the Birmingham Housing community as a good one to cover. And
the
she's an
Broadway,
excellent one
Broadway
to cover.
Broadway Housing Community?
Yeah, Broadway Housing Community, yeah.
Yeah.
She is excellent, and she spent a year in Giel on a fellowship after she graduated from college, and I'm repeating what's in the book, but she came back. She'd always been interested in mental illness, and when she'd been in, I can't remember the school she went to, but she made arrangements to work in a hospital to learn more about mental illness, and she made the observations that were true, an institutionalization of the confinement. And then she also knew that in New York there were so many homeless and so on. And so I tell the story of how she chose to fight that with a not against with attitude. And she's done amazing work in New York. And for example, one of the first housing communities that she, one of the first housing buildings that she opened, she wanted it to have apartments for families, okay? That didn't go over so big with some of the people who were approving and giving funding because they did not think that children should be in the same building with people who have a diagnosis of mental illness. And she thought it was so important that people have, if you're going to live a normal life, an expected life, you're going to want your family with you in some cases. And so the first place that she opened, she had to really fight it, but she got it so that families could live together, and they live in apartments, and they offer services for those families. They have a daycare, they have a computer room where people can look for jobs and so on. Well, not only did the community have to welcome in, were being tacitly asked to welcome these people into their community, but everything that was offered in the building was also offered to the neighborhood. So there was a blend, and you couldn't tell really where the where the community began, where the community in the building began, and where the neighborhood began. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And from the book, I think I remember it was the approach that Ellen was taking looked at more of a poverty approach. Am I right on that?
Well, it has, and her latest project has focused on poverty. The reason being that a community's problems, a community's resources and concerns can change with the times. And homelessness had become more of a problem. And so, and poverty is not a good way for a child to grow up. So this last project that she had that's in Harlem, there was a lottery where a certain number of people were accepted based on poverty and a certain number of people were accepted based on mental illness. So it gets kind of complicated. I've tried to simplify it in the book, but I think maybe what you can see is if we take this approach of, okay, we're going to get rid of mental illness, we're going to solve this problem, you're painting yourself in a corner.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just from some notes that I took in the book, it looks like she raised about $17 million and turned basically created a apartment buildings to create this community, and there was multiple levels of government and different partnerships and philanthropy in place to get that off the ground.
Right.
Am I right on that?
Yeah, she, when I've talked to her, and she compares herself to, but in New York, there is Community Access, I believe, is the other one. And he's been very successful, too, the one that's involved with Community Access. Well, what Ellen told me in simple terms is that the approach that he's taken is to get funding, government funding, and so on. And Ellen has put more of an emphasis on philanthropy. Mm. Now, I'm sure there's an overlap there, but there are different. Sometimes you got to get both. Interestingly enough, I don't know if it applies to this, but I'm downsizing my house, and one of the things that I wanted to get rid of was some bunk beds. I had a twin over double bunk bed, and the people who were going to buy it came yesterday to pick it up, and I asked them what they were going to do with it. Well, they are beginning there, and they're getting government funding. This, and I'll come back to this, but they're not getting any funding through grants or things like that. And they're opening their home to people with disabilities. And I said, well, what kind, physical or mental? And they're not very precise about it. Their initial concern is for teenagers who are homeless or pregnant. So that's their initial thing. And I asked her about funding, and she said, that's too hard to get. These people get disability, and so this sounds good, and it often is good, but I've also seen where the people are taken advantage of. So a foster home, a foster facility might know how much disability the person gets, and they might gauge the rent towards what is going to be available to them in disability payments. However, then what can happen is they have nothing left over to buy the things that they need for transportation and things like that. So, and I discovered that many years ago when I was visiting a place here in Birmingham, a drop-in place here in Birmingham, and they wanted, wanted donations of towels and shampoo and things like that because the people had to give so much of their disability check to pay the rent, because that's how the houses were run with the rent. That was the source of funding that the boarders didn't have any money left for their necessities of life. And, you know, what city are you in Canada?
Just outside of Toronto.
Toronto. Okay. I've visited Toronto. I think what I remember about Toronto is it's the most multicultural city in North America. Is that right?
Yep, for sure.
Yeah.
If not the world, yeah.
Yeah. So one of the problems that you might have to deal with, which can be a lack of resources by the community, is that people with disabilities of any kind are not going to have transportation readily available to them. Now, the big cities in the United States, like New York, it has mass transit. Washington does, Atlanta does. California does to a limited degree, but not real good. But cities like Birmingham don't. We have buses running, but those buses are scheduled for primarily people who are doing housekeeping work in the wealthier suburbs. And so that does not, and I remember when I moved into, I grew up in a small town, and when we moved into the suburb, I thought, oh, great, I can take a bus to go someplace. Not unless I wanted to go to a part of town where I wanted to clean a house and then wanted to get home when I was done cleaning the house. So transportation can be a real problem. It is a problem to overcome. And so what you have to do is see, you know, what have we got? I went around, I can't remember what city I was in, and I rode around with somewhere in Wisconsin with a caseworker, and he had a person with him who was, he was dealing with, and they were talking about jobs that she could have because she really wanted to work. But sometimes the jobs were at places where she couldn't get to them because of lack of transportation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're pointing out a couple of really important points, and your point around your whole disability pension or check going towards housing would be the equivalent of, you know, having a mortgage payment that's your full paycheck, right?
Exactly.
So how do you eat? How do you get around? So it's a super important consideration and a reality that a lot of people with disability face.
Go ahead.
I was going to say the other point around transportation, right? So it's great to have a home, but you it doesn't do an individual much good if they're isolated in their home and they don't have a way to get to being engaged in what they want to be engaged in.
Exactly. And so going back to the beginning that I said the important thing was to evaluate the needs of your clients and the resources of the community. Well, I talked more in regard to personal needs of the client based on their illness or their personality, their interests, and so on. But transportation is a need, and it's going to be different in different communities. And so there you have to combine the need with the resource.
Right.
And what does the community have to offer? Here in Birmingham, there are some vans that you can call to get to different places. It's not always satisfactory. It's not as easy as when you have mass transit like they do in New York and so on. But it's something that you can't ignore. You can't brush it aside.
Exactly. So there's a lot of different communities and models that you talk about in your book. Maybe we could just touch on one other that's maybe a little bit different than what we've talked about so far. Would you be able to talk to a model like, if I'm pronouncing this right, Gould Farm?
Gould Farm is an old one, and it started, it might be the oldest one. Oh, I love Gould Farm. I loved staying there. And it actually started because Mr. Gould, whatever his name was, I can't remember, he wanted to help people in need, so it kind of reminds me of Greensboro, Alabama. And so he would have people who were recovering from surgery that would stay there. And it was, once again, it's an agrarian community, and Gould Farm is a self-sustaining farm. They make or grow everything that they use. And so that's one point that it is similar. And I think that the wife knew of Giel and was inspired by Giel when they started. So they started out just kind of in the tradition of colonial America of providing a place for people in need. And that could just be a need of recovering from surgery. And now it's primarily people who have a mental disability. But what I love about Gould Farm is at Gould Farm, I got to stay there. Everybody that works at Gould Farm lives at Gould Farm. Even the staff, if the staff have children, the children live there. So it's a community in and of itself. And you go into the dining hall at night and you look around, or the breakfast, and you, for me, I wasn't looking to, I didn't know who were the boarders and who were the staff. And so Gould Farm is wonderful. Now, Gould Farm is one of those therapeutic communities where you have to pay if you're going to have somebody stay there. And the people who the family who opened the place in Michigan, their son went to Gould Farm to begin with. They were very wealthy, and they thought that and they were told that there was no hope for him, but they went to a hospital out east and then learned about Gould Farm, and they put their son at Gould Farm, and they ended up starting something similar in Rose Hill, Michigan, in Holly, Michigan, Rose Hill Center. And here their son, who was, I suppose, paranoid, schizophrenia, I don't know, but he is now helping to run the community at Rose Hill Center. So the family had the money to start Rose Hill Center. They had the means to let their son try out Gould Farm for a while, and from that grew the realization that they wanted to do something similar in Michigan.
Yeah, it's really interesting, the theme of taking that model from Giel and adapting it to different models across the United States, and you know, even those kind of initial adapted models, like you mentioned, Gould Farm has adapted, there's been other offspring such as Rose Hill. So it's really interesting to see that evolution.
The evolution, the family tree of it, yeah. And, you know, I want to say that I don't know how many places use Giel as a model. I would be surprised when I'd visit places that workers, didn't know about Giel. And so I had given a couple presentations about Giel, and as I said in the book, the people who were working in the sites that I was visiting said, "Oh, yeah, Giel, I remember Giel. Whatever happened to Giel?" And they remembered reading it when they were getting their training. And so I thought, okay, if I'm going to continue to talk about Giel, I've got to give it some meaning to North Americans. And so that's when I started looking for places that had, and I have a chapter about this, that offered some of the opportunities, some of the conditions that existed in Giel. They existed in Giel because it was a legend that stayed with the city and became their trademark. But in other places, the intuition of what the people need and what we learned about what people need, the ones who were defining that may never heard Giel. So in some way, we can say that common sense tells us what people need.
Right. And sometimes we forget to use common sense.
Yeah. When I was training volunteers for CompTIER, and I would have one time somebody, I'm isolating a question, but it's so indicative of the way the thinking goes sometimes. And so CompTIER operates somewhat under the same model of Big Brother, Big Sister. In other words, you have a community volunteer who's matched up with a population in need. So they would be matched up with in CompTIER, you're matched up with someone who has a diagnosis of a mental disability. So when I was doing the training, one time somebody said, "Well, what if the person that you're matched with calls you too much?" And I said, "Okay." I said, "Do you have any friends who call you too much?" "Yeah." "Well, what do you do?" "Well, I say I'm busy, and can I call them back later?" I said, "Bingo, that's what you do."
Right.
And so you really can take the common sense rules that you use in your own social life, and you can apply them to your interaction with whoever has a disability.
Mm-hmm. It's so simple, but it's an important message to get out there.
It's important because it has to be individualized. My father was an amputee, and his leg was amputated before I was even born, so I always knew him that way. And he had a lot of pride, so he got around pretty well. But But there were certain things that were difficult. And one of the things that he would sometimes get mad at my mother, if you're an amputee, you don't want any throw rugs around the house. And so, you know, mother had to be careful not to do that. And her decorating sense kind of went against that. But you have to take that into consideration. A ramp was more difficult for my father to go down than steps.
Right.
That seems counterintuitive. But the one fall I saw him have was when we were out to dinner and he was going down the ramp. And the ramp kind of gives you a momentum that you can't have control over. And he fell hard. I had to use CPR because he had kind of half swallowed his dentures. Well, so another, so using that as an example, if you have in Compare, for example, if you have someone who has schizophrenia, the drugs that they might take for the schizophrenia might make them photosensitive so that they shouldn't be out in the hot sun. Well, you're not going to do them any favors to take them to an afternoon baseball game. So the needs of the boarder, the client, the disabled person, whatever, the needs of that person need to be evaluated at many levels, what they want to do, what they're able to do, what they need to avoid. And so you can't just treat them as a group. You have to treat them as individuals.
Mm-hmm. So I just have one last question here for you. It's a short one. So if you had a billboard that the whole world would see, what would you put on that billboard?
Goodness gracious. As you can tell, I'm not good on slogans. Something that would emphasize the importance of recognizing our abilities in addition to our disabilities. Our disabilities, and we all have some to a certain degree, our disabilities must be considered, but we cannot overlook our abilities, because it's the abilities that allow us to have contact with other people, it's the abilities that allow us to feel like meaningful members of the community. So something along those lines. I'd need somebody who is better at one-liners than I am. But I think that's a very important thing. And you know, back to my beginning, communities have different resources, patients have different needs, and so on. What we need to do in order to identify the resources and the needs and so on is we have to not just identify the disabilities, not just the lack of transportation or the inability to go out in the sun, but what are the positive things, not against, with.
I love that, Jackie. And that's a great note to wrap up the podcast here. So super grateful for you creating the time to chat with me today. And I think everybody's going to get a lot of value to this. So thank you very much. Big thank you to Jackie Goldstein for coming on the podcast and sharing the things that she has observed over the years on community care models all across the world. And stay tuned for a podcast that'll be coming up again with Jackie, where we talk about stigma and how to start to break down stigmas in general, but we focus in a little bit on disability and mental illness. So I think you're going to enjoy that. Also, I encourage you to pick up Jackie's book, Voices of Hope for Mental Illness, Not Against With. If these community care models are of interest to you, you can grab it on Amazon. And Jackie also is touring around doing speaking engagements. So if you're interested in Jackie speaking at your event or to your organization, I include her email address in the show notes of the podcast. So go ahead and grab that information there. And if housing is something that you're working on, feel free to go to the website and get the free download on creating your home. So there's this great workbook that's going to help guide you through creating your vision and starting to implement your vision for what your home looks like. So go on over to the website. It's empoweringability.org. And I think you'll get a lot of value out of that. I'd like to thank all of our listeners that have left us a review on iTunes. Your reviews help me understand what I'm doing well, what I can improve on the podcast, what you want to hear. So it's great feedback that you're providing. So please continue to do so. Also, by leaving a 5-star review, it helps other people find the podcast. So thanks so much for those reviews. Next week on the podcast, we have super funny guest David Roche. And David was born with a facial difference. And David shares a bit about his story on his journey throughout life and reinventing himself and his journey of self-acceptance. So David and I are going to do a great conversation about how to find your own inner George Clooney. And I think it's a super valuable podcast for everybody to listen to. So stay tuned next week for my interview with David Roche. And again, thank you so much for listening today, and we'll catch you next week.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast. Visit us at empoweringability.org for more podcasts and resources to help you and your loved ones impacted by disability build a full and meaningful life.